This is WBOY Presents. I'm Sean Beter. Let's get back to my recent interview with NPR correspondent Kelly McEvers, who visited Fort Wayne this week. It's been obviously a very busy news summer overseas, especially. And this month in particular has underscored, you know, again, how dangerous it can be to be a war correspondent. You know, we've had the death of James Foley at the hands of ISIS. I'm curious, did you know Jim Foley?
I didn't. No, I didn't know him. But, you know, he was a member of the tribe, so of course I knew of him.
Right.
He covered places that, I mean, the road where he was kidnapped is a road that I drove along after he was kidnapped, and remember thinking, oh, I don't like this road very much. You know, covered all these parts of northern Syria that we're talking about that were controlled by the rebels, but, you know, increasingly deep into 2012, early 2013, you started seeing more and more the presence of these Islamist fighters, people from different countries, some of them Syrian, and more we heard stories of people being taken, of being kidnapped, and it obviously cast a chill over our thinking about how we covered the region.
Well, that was going to be my question. I mean, even if you're in the zone doing your job,
yeah,
that has to be somewhere in your mind.
We stopped. I mean, we stopped going into Syria, period. Like, we stopped. Like, there was a point where the number of people who were being held, thought to be being held by Islamist militants, was so high, there was just no way. I mean, as a news organization, NPR made the call, like many news organizations. And our team, I mean, we were the reason they made the call, said, you know, no way, we're not going in here. It was after Jim, you know, got taken and a few other people got taken. I mean, at one point it was, you know, 30 to 40 people being held. It was kept pretty quiet because sometimes if you keep it quiet, it helps to try to negotiate their release. And it was after, you know, Jim's getting taken was definitely one of the reasons we decided that.
It seems like it's a matter of business almost to the folks who are targeting journalists. I mean, did you get a sense while you were there anyway that, I mean, journalists were specifically being targeted, or was it just any American, any European citizen?
Right, because they take aid workers too. We, you know, again, while I was going into Syria, there was not that sense. But again, right around early 2013, mid-2013, we decided, nope, we're not going in anymore. It became clear that they're taking people. And then a few months later, we started to, you know, get the reports and get the real sense that to some degree it was about money, about, you know, then trying to get a ransom for these people who they'd kidnapped. I mean, at one point, before the militants known as the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL, they have a bunch of different names, before they took over Mosul in Iraq, recently, their main source of funding was ransoms.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they asked for more than $100 million for Jim Foley.
For Jim, right, which led people to think that it wasn't a realistic request because most of the others were in the sort of $2-5 million range. And also, I mean, I think the militants themselves know that the American government and the British government does not pay ransoms. And so there was always a sense, I've heard anecdotally, this is not, you know, confirmed, but stories about how they would sort of separate the Brits and the Americans from the others because they would know that they could get money for the others.
I'm curious kind of what you think about the rise of ISIS or the Islamic State or ISIL. They didn't come out of nowhere, but they don't feel like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. This feels different somehow. Can you talk a little bit about ISIS?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was this moment in Syria, and we all saw it. Every time when I would go to cross the Turkish border into Syria, you had to take a plane from Istanbul into, you know, a couple of different places. There's this town called Antakya, and there's a town called Gaziantep, and these are Turkish cities basically right on the Syrian border. And these are these little local flights from Istanbul. It's like a couple hours. And I swear to you, every time I got on one of those planes, I'd look around and be like, well, who are all these guys? You know, and they looked like they were coming from different places. places that were not the Arab world, you know, and they'd say they were doctors and aid workers. You know, I'm not totally generalizing, but I mean, there was just this time when not only were the Turks just turning a blind eye when we would cross the border, journalists, but they were turning a blind eye to everyone crossing the border. And, you know, surely the Turkish intelligence knew this at the time, and surely so did their partners, American intelligence. You know, we didn't have a whole lot of intelligence. The U.S. government didn't have a whole lot of intelligence assets on the ground inside Syria. We know that from our reporting. But surely they had assets on the ground in terms of their partners in Turkey. And surely they saw these guys going in. And I think the sense on the part of the Turks was, let's let them go in and fight against our enemy Assad, and we'll deal with them later. Well, guess what? You know, they blossomed and grew into something very nasty. And what they did was, I mean, but that wasn't everything, right? And some of these guys were from London, as we know, Australia, the United States. There was a guy who blew himself up in Syria from Florida. But what they did was they joined up with this much more entrenched and established organization called the Islamic State of Iraq, which is basically al-Qaeda in Iraq, that had been around for a long time, since Zarqawi, since the Americans were present. You know, it was part of the sort of resistance to the American presence. And this is a very brutal organization that had, you know, banded together in lots of different ways in Iraq, one of them in prison, you know, in American prisons and Iraqi prisons. They had years and years of experience, of tactical experience on the ground, with suicide bombings, with the killing of Shiites. And so I think on the one hand, you know, because of that, we see them as this kind of, oh, they're just a local entity. They really just want to kind of control some territory in Iraq and Syria. But I don't think we should discount them at all, especially when you have this international element.
And in fact, they've marched from Syria through much of Iraq by
right.
now.
And taking hundreds of millions of dollars and uncountable amount of U.S. equipment along the way. I mean, these guys are driving...
Of U.S. equipment.
They're driving American Humvees, you know. I mean, they're using American equipment that they took from, you know, bases, U.S. bases that were left behind to the Iraqi army. I mean, these guys are not messing around. They've got field experience and... You know, while they may be using that equipment to just, you know, take more territory in Iraq and Syria, they're not going to stop there. I mean, I don't want to be too alarmist, but I don't think, I think they're pretty proud of themselves right now. And I actually follow a lot of these guys on Twitter because a lot of them speak English, and there's a lot of bragging going on. There's a lot of, like, you know, we're coming for you.
You follow a lot of ISIS fighters.
Yeah, on Twitter. Oh, yeah, they're out there. They're very proud of themselves. They're very proud of what they do. Beheading is very cool right now. It's like a status symbol. I mean, these are young guys who want to believe in something, want to join something. I mean, we all know what that feels like, you know, to be like 20 years old and do something that you feel like is important and that you believe in. I think it's easy for us to look at what they did to Jim Foley and say, well, they're crazy. I think, you know, that's dangerous. They're not crazy. They're very calculated and very tactical, and they're very real. And I do believe that they could be a threat to the U.S. and that, who knows, maybe at some point they do join back up with al-Qaeda, you know, once they've got the territory. Maybe they put their differences aside. That said, I am not an alarmist, and I'm not an interventionist. You know, I don't think we should just rush to start another war in the region. We all know what that means. And I also don't think tactically that you know, that's going to be the only thing that's it takes to defeat these guys. It's going to take a lot more than just some airstrikes to defeat these guys.
Such as?
Getting the Sunnis back. There are people in Iraq and Syria who feel completely abandoned, who feel like the world turned away from them while their own government gassed them with sarin gas, while their own government bombed them with fighter jets, while their own government tortured them to death. There are almost 200,000 people dead in Syria, and the world watched it happen. And they say, who else do we have? Who else is going to come and help us? That's their thought. In Iraq, it's sort of the same thing. You've got the Sunnis who say there's this Shiite sectarian government that the U.S. put in power and then walked away, and while they, you know, put us in jail. These are the only people who care about us. us. These are the only people who believe in us. Now, what happens, I think, is when these moderate Sunnis realize that, you know, that the ideology that these guys have, the Islamic State has, is pretty intense, I think they might think, wait a second, maybe this is not what we want. So what you need to do is exactly what the U.S. did, I think, in 2006 and 2007, is split the radicals from the moderates and make sure that the moderates are working to get rid of the bad guys. But that's a tall order when nobody trusts you anymore. I mean, everybody walked away from him. Why should they trust us now?
We've been hearing on NPR and elsewhere about, you know, what could be next in fighting ISIS. And we've heard tales of strange bedfellows being made.
Right.
I mean, the United States essentially lining up on the side of the Assad regime against ISIS.
Right. I mean, when you ask U.S. officials about this right now, they say absolutely not. He's a murderer. We cannot ever imagine a day we're going to be partners with him. But it's hard to imagine, I think other analysts will say, it's hard to imagine that a day when we don't have to partner with him on some level. And then this is exactly what he wanted all along. For him to come to the world, there was a press conference today. His foreign minister gave a press conference, you know, saying, we joined the world coalition to fight ISIS. And boy, isn't that convenient and wonderful for them. It's like, where have you been for the last 2 years? You know, they haven't been fighting ISIS for the last 2 years. I think that's what officials would say. But, you know, to some degree, you have to think that there's going to have to be some working together. I'm not sure. I know that I saw one former intelligence official saying they're not that helpful. So, I mean, if we do work with them, what are they going to really do? Other officials say that, you know, we don't need their permission to launch airstrikes over the country because their air defense systems really aren't that powerful, you know, because there's a concern, right? If our planes are flying over Syria, they'll shoot them down unless we ask their permission first. Well, you know, at least some people have told me that the places where ISIS is in the sort of the far northeast of Syria, there really isn't a strong air defense system at all anyway. So we don't really have that concern. You know, it's hard to know. The administration is certainly talking like it's thinking about ramping this up and crossing over the border. There are surveillance flights already going on, drone surveillance flights already going on at the border. They're peeping into Syria. What they do next, I do not know.
I want to pivot a bit to your decision to leave the region. You lived in Beirut for a while with your family. I'm wondering, what was life like in Beirut?
Yeah, people hear Beirut and they think of the civil war in the 80s, you know, the horrific attack on the U.S. embassy and the Marine barracks that killed so many people, and then the just bloody 15-year civil war. That is not the Beirut that is now. Beirut is a place of beaches, nightclubs, restaurants, bikinis, wine, amazing food. You know, it's shopping. It's a place where all the Arab world goes to play. It's a former French colony, so it's got this brilliant architecture. It could not be more different than people imagine it. That said, the problems in Syria, without question, have affected Lebanon, the country, and have come home to roost in Beirut. I mean, we've seen a couple of really horrific car bombings in Beirut, but there was one really high-profile bombing in the Christian part of Beirut and targeting the chief of intelligence. You know, broad daylight, killed civilians, something you don't normally see. Car bombings are usually very targeted. They target an official. I mean, the prime minister of the country was killed in 2005 by a car bomb, but they usually don't target officials. So, I mean, there's definitely been an escalation of tensions, of clashes, but they rarely reach the heart of Beirut. And so Beirut is Beirut. Beirut will party like it's 1999 until it can't anymore. And even then, it'll still try, I think.
It's surprising that it sounds like such a, I don't know, cosmopolitan
city. Oh, God, no, it's the best. I mean, as the Paris of the Middle East, it's always been that place. I mean, ask any Arab where they would, you know, prefer to spend a weekend. And it's Beirut. I mean, it's just, and you'll see, you know, women in miniskirts walking down the street hand in hand with a woman in a full chador. You know, I mean, it's very diverse. I mean, you have extremely devout Shiites aligned with, you know, sort of Hezbollah and other Shiite political groups and militias and stuff. And at the same time, you'll see completely secular Lebanese, lots of mixed marriages, a very thriving, huge Christian population. Obviously, they were a major factor in the previous civil war when it was kind of Christians against Muslims. Now the conflict is more about Sunnis versus Shia. But yeah, I mean, you know, all of the different factions, of course, exist. exist in under one roof in Parliament, which is totally messy and there's constant fighting, you know, and to some degree, politically, it's not a very functional place, but it somehow manages to be a state that lopes along. You know, there's power outages every day, but that's sort of part of the allure too. You know, there's actually an app in Beirut. You can, they have rolling power outages, and so you can just set your app so you'll know when the power's going to be out of your house, so you just don't go home.
There's an app that'll tell you when.
Yeah, when the power's going to be out. Mm-hmm. There's an order to it. I mean, that's Beirut. There's an order to the chaos.
You'd been doing this kind of reporting for a while by the time you moved to Beirut. I'm curious about the build-up to your decision, I guess, to leave Beirut.
Yeah, I wasn't leaving Beirut. I was leaving conflict. You know, again, I sort of backed into being a conflict reporter. I never really planned to be a conflict reporter, never really wanted to be a conflict reporter. And then in 2012, sort of all I was doing was kind of being a conflict reporter. I mean, if I wasn't sneaking into Syria, I didn't do it that many times, but if I wasn't, that we were sitting in the office watching these horrific videos that citizen journalists would upload from Syria, you know, day in, day out, day in, day out, and it took a toll. And you know, it's funny, had I stayed, I think I would have moved in sort of into the sort of post-conflict stage. But then now, where would I be? I'd be in northern Iraq reporting on the conflict there, you know. So I just think there comes a time for everybody when they decide whether they have to decide whether or not they want to be a conflict reporter. And some people decide to continue doing it. And I just took my time to say, this isn't something I don't want to do right now. And I took a break.
Well, it's something that I think probably a lot of folks don't think about is, you know, there are soldiers who
don't get the choice,
are in these conflicts. They come home and they can't get rid of those conflicts in their minds. Is that something that you've been through, if you don't mind me asking?
Sure.
Or is something that you've seen colleagues, other members of the tribe go through?
PTSD is totally real. I think there's this weird thing that's happening is like there's like there's a new understanding about it where everybody talks about PTSD, but I think in some ways that's made us understand it less because we could just call everything PTSD and not really know what PTSD is. I'm not a soldier. I got to choose when I could leave, you know, just when I had, you know, somebody who signed up and who's on their fifth tour of Iraq or Afghanistan, they don't have the choice. I also didn't carry a weapon. I never had to kill anybody. Let's just be straight up. You know what I mean? So yeah, I probably have some PTSD, but I don't have it like our, you know, colleagues who served. And PTSD is totally real. Everybody's got their own valid reasons for it. I mean, I'm not trying to discredit anything. And, you know, I think all of us need to, you know, seek professional help. I have done so. National Public Radio, like, we've got a person on retainer who we can call at any time. I have called him. He has been unbelievably helpful to me. I would recommend it to anybody who's been in the same situation. But no, I'm not in a place where, you know, the sound of thunder makes me jittery, you know. But yeah, when I'm in Los Angeles and I hear a helicopter flying overhead, sometimes I just wince, you know, or, you know, even just, I mean, I'll be like at work, you know, and on Tuesday afternoon and I'll walk by the TV and I'll see Syrian refugees on the TV and I just kind of have to get stopped in my tracks because I know that and I've lived it and I have to just let that moment happen instead of to try to ignore it and pretend it's not there.
Was there a moment, one moment, I guess, that made you finally decide to leave conflict reporting, to leave Beirut?
No. Nope. There wasn't. I kind of wanted to stay. And I made this, you know, this 1 hour kind of very personal radio documentary about it. And I remember telling the producer, Jay Allison, who's a longtime radio producer, when we embarked on the project, I was like, you know, if I do this, I bet it'll make me quit my job, which I was being kind of stark because I didn't like quit my job, but, you know, quit my job in the as a conflict reporter in the Middle East. And it wasn't really, and by the time I finished making it, I still wanted to stay. I mean, I was like thinking about all the stuff and we'd thought about it and talked about it, but I still wanted to stay. But I think in some ways it was putting that out there and getting people's reaction to it. Like, so many people just said to me, like, what? Why haven't you left yet? You know, that made me think, oh, maybe I should. That was part of it. My family was part of it, for sure. But no, there wasn't any single event, really. I still wanted to tell people's stories.
So what do you wish that Americans understood better about the Arab world that maybe maybe we don't understand well now? You know, what are we missing here from the Syria story or from the ISIS story or from what's going on even in Iraq?
That it is a beautiful place with a long and rich and incredibly diverse and fascinating history, that the culture and the language and the food and the music and the clothes, I mean, are just whatever it is you imagine about the Middle East, it's nowhere close to what it really is. That there right now are hundreds of villages in Iraq and Syria where people are having delicious meals and where family is the most important thing to anyone ever, anywhere you go, where the hospitality is something you cannot imagine. Somebody will, you'll be standing in a mud-filled refugee tent and people will bend over backwards to give you the most delicious cup of tea. They're so proud. And it's hospitality, I cannot overstate, it's so important to them. They will do anything for a guest to make you feel welcome and included and protected and special. It's just, and it's a place where women, all kinds of women, have a completely different access to life than most Americans think. People always ask me, wasn't it hard to be a woman? And it's like, no, it was great to be a woman. It was fantastic to be a woman, like I said before, because I could access everybody as a woman in really, really conservative villages. Yeah, the women are kind of kept a little bit separate. It's seen as just a little bit uncool to let your wife talk to a strange man. Not totally because of religion. It's more sort of a tribal thing. It's like you just wouldn't, you don't want to put someone in danger by talking to a strange man, because back in the old days, the way one tribe would defeat another would be to come into a village and take all its women. That's what you did. I mean, so this is like this thing. And like people think it's all because they're all like Taliban and, you know, super religious. That's not what it is. It's so much more nuanced than that, the situation for women. And it's really the only way you can understand it is to kind of live it and to be, you know, I lived in a place like Saudi Arabia where women couldn't drive, but women are CEOs. You know, I lived in a place like Lebanon where women can wear bikinis if they want and are in parliament, you know. And so, you know, I mean, it's just lots and lots and lots of degrees and lots of nuances and a place that is older and more diverse in its history and culture than anything we know.
You live in California now, reporting for NPR on income inequality and the disappearing middle class.
So. Yeah, and I'm doing some immigration stuff and then some police brutality stuff, too.
How has the transition gone? I mean, that's a very, in some ways, a very different track to take.
Right, yeah. I am a journalist, and so I'm like, I was worried that I wouldn't, I was like, maybe I won't care about all these stories as much as I cared about that stuff. And it's just totally not true. As soon as I start reporting something, I'm like, wow, did you guys, this is amazing. Did you believe this is happening? I mean, it's just the same exact thing happens over and over again. Maybe the stakes are lower. The people I'm reporting on aren't going to die if my story doesn't get out there. And maybe that wasn't true anyway. But there's so much going on in this country right now, so much worth talking about. The economic picture, the kind, you know, our sluggish recovery from the recession and sort of how some people are recovering great and other people are not. And that gap is getting wider. And why is that happening? And what can we do about that? That's super fascinating to me. The immigration debate alone is unbelievably fascinating to me. Living in a place like California, this, you know, basically the world's sixth largest economy, a place where the immigration debate's sort of over. I mean, even Republicans support immigration reform. So to kind of live in that perch and watch the rest of the country debate this is interesting. You know, I've been spending a lot of time in Albuquerque looking at the police department and sort of the complications of this idea now that we've all talked about since Ferguson about when to use force and how much force to use and how are police departments trained. Like, we've just got a lot to talk about and to do in this country. And I'm super psyched to be a part of it.
Despite being super psyched, so, do you ever feel the urge to go back?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Yep. I mean, look, it's not like you can get a visa to the Islamic State right now. I mean, that's the story to tell. And, you know, I think I'd be much more tempted to go back if there were like a more accessible, less insanely dangerous story out there. You know what I mean? If like Yeah. There was some major political upheaval in Syria, like a transition of power. I would want to go back. And maybe I would go back. I mean, there's just no, I'm never saying never. There's nothing that's going to stop me from going back if I want to, and if NPR wants me to, and if my family's okay with it, you know, but just on a break right now. And honestly, the stuff that's going on is making it pretty easy to kind of stay away, at least for the moment.
Kelly McEvers, thank you so much for taking time out for us. We really appreciate it, and we're glad to have you in Fort Wayne.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to WBOY Presents and our interview with NPR correspondent Kelly McEvers. Today's program was produced by Katie Anderson and myself. I'm Sean Beter. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of WBOY Presents.